Good evening. We are going to be studying Psalm 127. It's a short one, but kind of like the 23rd Psalm, but just so rich, so packed full of good stuff. We're just going to take the first two verses of Psalm 127. If you have a Bible, I will also have it up here on the screen. Back up one, and here we go. Unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. For he gives to his beloved even in his sleep. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. So we're just going to start with verse 1 and only tackle 2 tonight. But he starts off and he says, unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain who build it. So the first question is this, how does the Lord build a house? Does he drive the nails? And of course not. Kind of like the CEO or the president of Boeing. He has planes made, but he doesn't drive any of the rivets himself. He has specialists or newbies, whatever, but he pays other people to do any welding, wiring, riveting. But he gives the directions, he gives the quality that they want, the standard of quality. He sets everything up, and if his workers honor him and honor the things that the CEO puts in place, then the plane, you know, theoretically gets built very well. And so with God, how does God build a house? Well, let's say it's a physical structure, because it may not be. It could be, but let's say it's a physical structure. And if you were teaching this, what would you say was God's method for building a physical house? And so you just think of everything that goes into it, right? You think of the finances, buying the property, the finances, all the planning, all the setup, And so that all has to be done, and it doesn't necessarily feel like God's building the house. So the way he built it is we put him in the center of the project. We pray that our motive for building the house is a good one, that it's going to honor and serve his kingdom, that the house is in our name, but it's really his house. And we want the house to honor him, his kingdom, his people. We want it to do good. And so one of the things we do is we just pray about it. And we also obey the codes, right? Not always easy to do. And we have some builders here, and sometimes that's we don't feel the codes are good, but nonetheless, if we want God to build the house, we follow the laws. We honor him, even if we think some of the laws are ridiculous. We treat the people that we, and I know you do, but we treat the people who are building it with respect and honor, but also keeping in mind that this isn't really our house, it's God's, and if they're cutting corners or something, we ask God for the courage to talk to them, to make it right. Because it's his house, not just our house. There's a lot more at stake than that. And so we get him involved in every single aspect of building this house, and we use the house for his glory. Maybe we have a potluck once in a while, or Bible studies, or just friends over. But somehow, and there are many ways to do it, we put him in the center of things. But it may not be a physical structure. It could be. It could be. But it could also be the family. If you read in the Old Testament, you're going to see that the house of is used a lot. There's the house of Jacob, the house of Joseph, the house of Levi. It's used several times, the house of, and has nothing to do with a building, because until Jacob moved to Egypt, and I don't know what he lived in then, but until he moved to Egypt, he lived in a tent all of his life. And yet in Genesis 46, and I think it's around 27, it talks about the household of Jacob had 70 people. Well, number one, they didn't live in a physical structure. Number two, they didn't all live together in the same tent or household, but this was the house of Jacob. And unless God builds the house, you know, the house of Potiphar, or Lilienquist, or Eccles, unless he builds it, those who labor, they labor in vain. And so, how do we get him involved in that? Every one of us wants God to be the builder of our structure if we have one of those built. Every one of us wants God to be the builder of our family. So how do we do that? Well, I'm going to refer back to Jacob in Genesis 46 because it says at that time there were 70 people in his household. Not his household, it says the house of Jacob had 70 people. So that means that Harold, your house is bigger right now than just Sue, because you have offspring. You and Sue have offspring and grandchildren, Sheila and Lee. Your household is bigger than just you two. So when we read things like Deuteronomy 6, which is very well known, sometimes not followed too well, but when we read that, this must apply to not just parents, but to anybody in the family that has influence, like grandparents. So Deuteronomy 6, beginning in verse 1, God speaking to Moses says, "Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments, which the Lord," I'm sorry, Moses speaking to the people, "which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess, so that you and your son and your grandson." I didn't really realize that until I started working on this sermon, that this applies to grandparents and grandchildren, unless God is the builder of the house, unless he builds the house. And I think this is at least involved, if not the house that the Lord is talking about right here. It talks about, anyway, the son and the grandson. And he goes on to say, "Might fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that you may, and that your days may be prolonged." Oh, Israel, we're adopted members of the tribe of Israel, as you know. We're spiritual Israelites. "Oh, Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it so that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey." And then it goes on to say, so how do you do that? When you get up, when you retire, when you're walking the way, when you're sitting in your home, and look, who doesn't want to do that? And how many good opportunities did I miss? Even though the desire was there, just not thinking about it. Just whatever, other things on my mind, or busy, or tired. But it makes the difference in God building a house. We let the young ones know, man, he is it. He's what we care about because he is the one that determines the success, not just of our soul, but of our house, of our family. So unless he builds a house, they labor in vain who build it. And I love that word vain because I was just thinking, well, didn't bring it up here, but what's a good example of vain? Because it means empty, worthless, meaningless. So if you know, we're building this structure or building a family and God isn't in the center of it, it just doesn't work out too well very often. That's what he wants to be, is he wants to be the builder in the center where everything is focused on him. So it goes well. And I thought about, well, how would we explain vain to Cyrus or somebody young, Christine? And I thought, you know, the Green River. We saw the Green River not too long ago. It kept raining recently and snowing, but the Green River got pretty full. So imagine taking a 5-gallon bucket down to the riverside. And let's see, 5 into 400. So 80 times you scoop it all the way full, you throw it out on the shore, and you scoop out 80 buckets. Mike, I've seen you work. And you worked harder than I did. I was worn out when we were chopping all that wood, and Dan and Morgan. But would 80 buckets weighing 40 pounds apiece, would you feel that at all? Yeah, most of us, I think even Dan would feel it for a moment or two, or maybe not Morgan. So what happens when you scoop out 80 buckets of water out of the Green River? Nothing. Not only that, but most of it flows back into the river, unless you carry it up a hill and take it a long way. It's just vain. We wouldn't do that. And so why build a house? Why build a family? But how do you do that? How do you not forget? Well, you're going to sometime. We're going to get distracted. But how do we make him the builder? So I think that's where, like, 1 Thessalonians 5:17 comes in, where it says, pray without ceasing. We won't do that perfectly, but if that's our mode, if that's our mindset, I just want to talk to you all day long, God, and every time when I get a break, at least you're on my mind, we're less likely to forget to talk to our children or our visitors about the Lord when they're sitting in our living room or when we're on a walk together. I don't think it's easy, but that's the key to success in building a home, building a family, building a life. If God is the builder, it should work well. Amen. So in the next part of verse 1, unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. Can you think of any Bible examples where there were probably watchmen, but it was totally a waste of time? Think of Babylon, maybe the highest walls I've ever read of around their city, 300 to 320 feet high, according to Herodotus and whatever his name is, and another guy that was there too. When Cyrus the Great, the Persian, came to Babylon, he said, I don't see a way we can take this city, not by force. And you know the story, but it's still an example. Certainly they must have had watchmen on, maybe they were overconfident, but either way, God wasn't guarding their city. He had been. Who made Babylon great? Yahweh did. In fact, when Nebuchadnezzar had that dream of that statue, Daniel made it clear to Nebuchadnezzar that this is what set up by God. Babylon, then Medo-Persian, then Greece, then Rome. And when Nebuchadnezzar got a little too haughty, remember chapter 4, a little too big in his own sight, God said, I'm going to have you eat grass for 7 seasons until you realize that I'm the one that appoints people, and I have to paraphrase it, but that gave this power and gave you success. But my point is, who made Babylon great? Who built the city? Yahweh did. But when his grandson took over, and God was no longer desired as their watchman, Cyrus diverted the Euphrates River, I believe it was the Euphrates, into a big lake bed until there was no water flowing down the river bed, and his soldiers walked in both ends of the city because the river went through the city. They walked in. They captured the city almost without firing a shot. Regardless of how many watchmen they had on the wall, they did it at night, so it was hard to see them. God was not guarding their city, and the city fell, one of the greatest cities that have ever existed. But what about the other way? What about the other way? Can you think of any Bible examples the city was in great trouble. But God was the watchman. And the soldiers didn't do anything. I mean, I can think of two, but I think three, unless I'm confusing. But I can think of two or three. I can think of the Roman general right before 70 AD and 66 AD. He has it surrounded. He runs. We talked about that in our Mark class. Think about when Hezekiah is king. They're surrounded by foreign armies. Didn't matter how many guards were up on the wall, but God was guarding the city and he delivered them. So we have a lot of examples of that. And although we don't live in walled cities anymore, do you think this applies to America? God was he was guarding our nation, our Constitution built. And this is not a political sermon at all, but it is a scripture one. So we built our nation, our Constitution, on principle, and our laws on biblical principles. And now that we're ignoring those, look at the trouble we've had for the past several years. Riots and just all kinds of things. And so I'm not saying he's not still guarding us to a point, but you can see that as we walk away from him as a nation, not us, but as a nation, I believe we're seeing the repercussions of that as a nation are not asking him to guard us anymore. Next verse, verse 2, he says, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors." I'm picking on the Olson family a lot, but you got a ranch. You have all this stuff going on. And just imagine you probably get up pretty early and you probably go to bed or you work long days. And he says, it is vain for you to do that. These guys are breaking rocks right now. They're not a chain gang. There's no whatever you call it, shackles on them. But some of us have done that, got up early. Your dad, Mike, we talked about this just on Friday, preaching full-time and had a full-time job as an electrician, his own company for a while. Rise up early, go to bed late. And isn't that the curse? It doesn't say those words, but isn't that the curse? When Adam's, he sinned, it says, from now on, the man will work by the sweat of his brow. So what's this talking about then? Is it wrong? Is it wrong for Lee Eccles when you had some farm animals, the sheep and so forth? Is it wrong for us to rise up early, go to bed late? I think there's a whole lot of stuff here. But one is this. In Zechariah chapter 4, God says to Zechariah, because they're trying to rebuild the temple, he says, not by strength or by might, not by man's strength, but by my spirit, he says. What is a great mountain? No great mountain, you should become a plain. Zechariah 4, around verse 7. Nothing wrong with working, getting up early, working hard, going to bed late, to a point, right? We're still putting God in the center. We have him as the focal point, and there's a need to do that for a while. But we're not full of fret. We're not thinking, I'm going to do this by my might. It is easy to squeeze God out of things sometimes. We just get so caught, I say we because I've done it. We get so caught up in the daily, bustle. I think sometimes we, at least with me, I forget to involve God, and I got to get this done, and I'm behind, and I don't have enough time in the day, and sometimes we rise up early, go to bed late, and we're not having him help us. So part of it is involving him, part of it is not fretting, saying, God, I'm going to do my part because he wants us to. Paul, talk about a man who went to bed early, got up. Jesus, sometimes he didn't go to bed at night at all. He'd pray, and during the day they were so busy they couldn't eat. But the idea here is still without God in the middle, it's vain. It's just not going to work well. And it's best not to do that for a lifetime. But sometimes it's necessary, and he's not saying it isn't. Just that he needs to be in the center. He needs to be the one we're calling on for strength. And you know, how often do you go to bed, and I hope none of you do, but how often do you go to bed like me, and you say, oh, I wish I would have worked smarter. I wish I would have had different priorities today, because Lord, I just don't feel like I served you well today. Not as a heathen, I just don't think like I got as much done as I could have. I believe we give it to God, say, help me grow from this. Bless what I did do, if you would, please, God. But just help me get better at prioritizing. Help me get better at focusing and forgetting the non-essential emails and all the other junk that sucks up our time. And help me have a great day tomorrow. Because you're my builder. And you're my guard. And so I just think it's pretty straightforward, but it's easy to sometimes overlook the details and forget that this should apply on a daily basis. This is probably my favorite phrase in the whole psalm. So back up just a second for context. Vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. If you don't do it on your own, it's a waste. Pull God in. Because, or for, he gives to his beloved even his sleep. That is just, that's such an incredible statement right there. He gives to us, his beloved, even in our sleep. Well, how does that work? Well, number one, in 1 Corinthians 4:7, it says, to you, Sheila, or me, or Andrew, what do you have that you didn't receive? Receive means given. What do you have that you didn't receive is the question. It's a rhetorical one. Paul is asking the Corinthians, because everything every Christian has, we received. Madonna, you have a nice car. You worked a lot of hours to get it, but was that a gift or did you earn the whole thing yourself? Was God involved in that or not? Yeah, very, very involved in that. He gave you the health, good enough health, so you could have that job. And he made things work it financially so that you didn't have a $10,000 termite bill in your home. And what about a job, if anybody's landed a job recently? What if you need a job? And so you're calling, but three people are calling the company at the same time for the same job you want. They're just about as qualified. They're as qualified as you are. Maybe they're not a Christian. So how does God do this? How does he give to his beloved his sleep? Well, maybe he just makes sure that at the moment these two other people call in, the boss just can't take the phone call. He's tied up. But when you call, he's open up. He's open, and he can take your call, and you get the job. But you're not sleeping, but that's the idea. So how does he work? How does he give to us, Jeff, when we're sleeping? How does he do that? And so you think about Bible examples and real-life examples, right? You think of the Jews are going to get exterminated in the book of Esther. And so why the Jews are probably sleeping for the most part? Here's the king, Xerxes, or Artaxerxes, I always forget his name, but he can't go to sleep. So he says, hey, well, bring me the Chronicles. I want you to read the Chronicles to me. What? Did I do anything for this guy Mordecai? Did I reward him? What's been done for him? Oh, nothing, king. So while everybody else is sleeping, God doesn't allow the king to sleep. So he chooses, for some reason, he chooses to have the Chronicles read. Oh, I overlooked this guy. No reward at all. And that started a chain of good events that saved the Jewish nation, because God was giving to his beloved even in their sleep. And he works in so many different ways. If I named 50, it wouldn't scratch the surface, would it? He's always, always working our lives. So what do you have? What do I have that we didn't receive? And he takes, and it says that in Romans 8:28, for we know. That's how that verse starts out. Some people skip that, but we know that God causes all things to work together for good for those that love him. We know it. Maybe faith forget it once in a while, but we know that. So things happen. God turns them into good, whether we're sleeping or not. But we call it providence, right? A miracle is something that defies the laws of nature. But God's providence is continual, ongoing, and in our lives, frequently, if not all the time, giving to his beloved, even when we're resting, singing in the church building, or sleeping, God gives to his beloved. So we're going to end there. And in 2 weeks, I would like to wrap up the second part of this psalm. Nothing new. Many of you have read this before. Just so good to hear those reassurances, and so good to have it broken down and maybe in a way we hadn't thought about recently, and to remember, I need to put him back in the center. I kind of let him slide to the side, put him back in the center where life is balanced, successful, good. Doesn't take away our challenges. We need those. But when he's in the center, not only does he give to his beloved, but he's the builder and he's the guardian, and life is good. With that, we'll have our song of invitation, I think 297. And so if you have a spiritual need, please let us know what it is while we stand and sing song of invitation.